Hey guys, this is Steve. I just wanted to let you know there's a tiny little bit of an issue with Scott's audio for the first couple minutes of this commentary, but it does clear up after about 5 minutes. So if you can just ride it out, everything after that sounds golden. So thank you for listening. Hey guys, thank you for tuning in to our next bonus episode of Science vs. Fiction. We are moving on in our Firefly series, watching episode 2, The Train Job. Now, this was episode 2 in the chronology of the story, but of course it was aired before the actual pilot episode, quite a bit before the pilot episode, it turns out, as the first episode that they ever aired on television. And so it functioned as the pilot for an audience watching for the first time, even though it is not the pilot of the thing. So now that we got all of that confusing chronology out of the way, Scott, why don't you tell them which version that we're watching?
We are about to watch episode 2 of Firefly. That is Dr. Stephen DeGennaro, a doctor of astrophysics. I, of course, am Scott, a longtime nerdy filmmaker and film critic who loves genre stuff.
I feel like if there are patrons, they know this. But, you know.
Oh, it just makes sense to introduce it. But we are now paused. We're watching on Hulu. So we have to warn you that we're going to be getting this little preface sequence that if you're watching on DVD or Blu-ray, you might not have. So your timing might be off because we're dealing with this little intro bit that they added so people will understand the series. Gah, whatever. It's so confusing. Anyway, we're on Hulu, paused at 0, and we're going to start the episode in 3, 2, 1, go. After the Earth was used up, that's what it says on my screen, we found a new solar system and hundreds of new Earths were terraformed and colonized. The central planets formed the alliance and decided all the planets had to join under their rule. There was some disagreement on that point. After the war, many of the independents who had fought and lost drifted to the edges of the system, far from alliance control. Out here, people struggled to get by with the most basic technologies. A ship would bring you work, a gun would help you keep it. A captain's goal was simple: find a crew, find a job, keep flying.
There you go. Read by the late Ron Glass.
Yeah, not much, much, much better than I read it. But I just added that because if you're watching on Blu-ray, it opens right here with this lovely lady dancing in front of this people playing cards and drinking coffee and walking.
In a very smoky bar.
Right. You wouldn't like, and I get why that's there on Hulu, so that, you know, if you're watching a random episode, you have the very basic gist of the series. And that's fine, but I don't need it.
Well, yeah.
I mean,
I think it does a really good job of just sort of, in as quickly, efficiently way as possible of just telling you, here are the rules of this world. Go, you know. And I guess it was especially important when they aired this without any context of the actual original filmed pilot. So here they are playing Chinese checkers, which is a real game that exists, is that a subtle nod, do you think, to the fact that they speak Chinese occasionally? Like, Chinese checkers has now become a game that lots of people play because China rose as a power in this world?
Yeah, I think it goes well beyond just the language. I think that the language, Chinese and English being married so closely by white characters who are, you know, in today's world would be probably Americans. And Chinese culture, it's not just in their language or their slang or their utterances. It's in the games they play. It's in the billboards. It's in the clothes. It's in the music. It's everywhere. And it just kind of speaks to the idea of that there had been some form of interesting Chinese how do you say it?
That China rose as a superpower.
Political.
In this world. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Some kind of. Because we're talking about a world in which they're not from Earth, you know? So where does this marriage of Chinese and English cultures come
from?
And
there it is,
interesting.
Speaking Chinese.
Yep.
From what I recall having read about this, they wrote this pilot or most of it after they found out that they weren't going to be able to do their original pilot as the first episode and they were told they needed something more action-packed. So I think they do a really good job in these opening sequences and in this episode as a whole, honestly, of introducing these characters anew to people that obviously at this point had no way of knowing who any of them were. And this opening scene is a great
Attention. I don't know the exact chronology of it, but I do know that you're right, that they were told, they being Joss Whedon and his co-creator Tim Minear, were told that this was not that the pilot was not going to be the pilot, and there was going to need an episode that both introduced the characters and also was kind of a slam bang heist slash action story.
Right. I mean,
and if those,
in all honesty, rewatching this last night, I do feel. I mean, like, I understand why you want the pilot to be the pilot, but like, if you know this episode as a whole does a really good job of introducing the characters, introducing the world. It's action packed. Like I can, you know, I don't want to defend the suits, but the suits. I don't want to say that they were right, but I don't think they were as wrong as they sometimes get lambasted for in terms of.
I want to say, let's say this. Let's say that the suits were dead stupid wrong, and yet still they somehow yielded a decent result.
I love that shot right there. You see the planets in the background, just kind of.
Yeah.
Subtly. Yeah.
And it's the way that, you know, in many ways, this is a very old school, dusty, dirty, grungy, Western type battle. But like you said, there's the planets in the background. There's the holographic window that keeps popping as they come flying out. And so, you know, in many ways, it, you know, it looks like a 50s Western, but there are, of course, sprinkles
in space,
sprinkles of,
futurism
and spaciness, one weird little nitpick I've always had with this episode is coming up here, right here. Mal looks down the cliff. There's nothing there. Nothing there.
Yeah.
And then a couple of seconds later, Wash shows up with the ship. Well, and dramatically, it's awesome. Right. But where is it? He would have seen him.
And then if you didn't see it, if you can maybe say like, okay, maybe it's flying really, really low through that valley right now. But you would certainly hear it before it came up over the cliff. But, you know, whatever.
And it's a great effect. Yeah. It looks nice, and it gives you a nice close-up, and then this establishing shot. Yeah. Because the Firefly, we've shown in the pilot episode that it is, in many ways, a small and quaint and kind of comfortable ship, tiny in its way, but yet in a situation like this, it's pretty imposing and scary.
Well, there's a great little line here, too, and this is, man, you know, every time, Joss Whedon is such a great writer, like that, here he says, damn yokels, can't even tell a transport ship ain't got no guns on it. Like, that is a line that, like, you know, it's clearly, it's meant to, it serves like four different functions at once. It's characterizing Jane.
Yeah, you're right.
It's letting the audience know who, again, don't know anything about this world at this point, letting them know this is a transport ship, not a warship. It's letting them know that they're the kind of people that would bluff this kind of thing, and it's just, it's carrying a lot of weight just in that one little line. And I really like it.
Yep. And it also, in a way, psychologically speaking, it tells me they're not the type of people who would think, hey, maybe we should have a couple of weapons.
Yeah.
They're just always content to go by the seat of their pants. That's it. They're fine with it. Whereas you or I would be like, hey, maybe we should have a couple cannons out there.
You know, and this all works. This little bit here does a good job, again, of there are a lot of little subtle expository lines that don't feel like expository lines because they're, you know, they work.
Reintroducing characters. Kaylee isn't reintroduced well. So is Jane and Wash to a degree. Obviously, you can't do what a 90-minute pilot did in 4 minutes. But
point of science. So the very last shot right before the credits started, they showed them flying past this planet, and it was a rocky planet, like an Earth-like planet, or a Mars-like planet, real, that had rings around it. Now, we've discovered lots of very weird planets in our searches of extrasolar planets over the last decade or two. So I would not say that this could never happen. It's very unlikely that you could form rings around a planet that small. So that feels like it's a bit of science fiction as opposed to science fact. Now, like I said, there are lots of things we thought we knew about planets. Even when I was in an undergraduate. So when I was an undergraduate, when I started undergrad in 1995, they had just discovered what turned out to be the first planet outside of our solar system. And now we know of hundreds of them. Everything that we thought we knew about how planets form and how solar systems form were completely upended by the last 20 years of finding all of these things, you know, like hot Jupiters, giant gas giants that are super close into their stars, which we didn't think could actually happen. And so there's, you know, there are the variety of planets that exist in the universe or in the galaxy is much bigger than we thought it was. We still don't think that kind of thing could happen, but I don't know, maybe it could.
So what you're saying is it's a stylistic choice that would doesn't necessarily make scientific sense, but only a tiny fraction of the universe would realize that that type of planet would not have rings.
Yes. Well, and you know, in this isn't a show where you're super worried about the fidelity to science all that much. Somebody did point out, actually, another science point. Somebody pointed out on Twitter to us that the sort of basic rules of this world may or may not make sense. If you own a starship, it means that you can get to and from space relatively easily. And that being sort of the most expensive part of space travel, if you were able to do that, if you were able to get enough fuel to regularly launch off of planets into orbit and back from the orbit back down onto the planet, you know, multiple times per episode, you probably are already rich. Like only rich people could, at least in our world, under the physics of our world, only rich people could afford enough fuel to get themselves off a planet. And so the idea that these guys are kind of, you know, scavengery, like, oh, you know, living hand to mouth, one paycheck to
the next. You know, it's interesting.
Not quite right.
Well, you know what? Let's try and keep a tally of that moving forward of like right now we know they're broke, but it is an interesting point that even no matter how low budget this crew might be, fuel is still expensive.
Well, so there's a way around that though. I was thinking about it. So, you know, like I said, somebody pointed this out to me on Twitter and I was thinking about it yesterday and realized that that assumes that the way to get into and out of space is the same way that we do now. Which clearly it isn't, because so the reason why it's so expensive, expensive here meaning like energy expensive, not even necessarily money expensive. The reason why it takes so much energy to get something off of the Earth into space is basically the way that a rocket works is you have something that you want it to move upward, and to get that thing to move upward, you use Newton's third law, which just says every action has an equal and opposite reaction. If you were standing on a truck, on a truck with like ice skates on it, and you threw something heavy out the back, it would push you forward a little bit. And so if you kept throwing heavy things out the back, it would push you forward faster and faster. And that's basically the way that a rocket works. You throw stuff out the back and it pushes the rocket upward. But the problem is, in order to do that, you have to carry those heavy things with you. And so the faster you want to go, the more mass you have to carry with you. The more mass you carry with you, the more mass you need to carry with you to throw out the back. And it becomes like this sort of self-reinforcing thing. And so like, in other words, like to launch the capsule that like the Gemini capsule, which hold, you know, it's a little tiny capsule, barely big enough to hold two people. You have to have this rocket that's like 20 stories tall, and most of that is just fuel. And you blow all that fuel out the back of the rocket, and by the time you get up to a speed where you can get into orbit, you've basically gone through all of your fuel. And so because you have to carry your fuel with you, essentially, is what I'm saying, long story short. So maybe in this world, I mean, clearly they don't need a giant rocket to get into space because they just have their thing. So they have some sort of drive that has some other mechanism for generating thrust that isn't just throwing mass out the engines. And so if you say that, then maybe it isn't that difficult to get to and from space.
But let's putting aside the propulsion to get you off a planet, doesn't it just stand to reason that the fuel necessary to get you through the vast expanses of space?
No, once you're in space, it's easy. Because once you're in space, all you got to do is give yourself a little kick and you'll keep going until you don't need to keep burning fuel.
Right, right. It's like if cruise control didn't take gas.
Exactly. Well, you could exactly. And so like once you give yourself that push, you'll just keep coasting until you get to where you're going. Now, you know, if you're going from inner planets to outer planets, you're working against the gravity of the sun a little bit. And so that would take some sort of energy. But like almost literally, like to get from an outer planet to an inner planet, all you got to do is actually slow yourself down a little bit so that you're no longer in orbit and you'll start spiraling in towards the sun because the sun will be pulling you in. And so like you'd be using, the energy of the sun to get yourself.
It's basically a much larger version of Tokyo Drift, Fast and Furious 3, I believe, right?
Yeah.
Point of science, the two women that we're looking at here are ridiculously gorgeous. And I do like, although it is kind of, to use a word I've used a lot lately, incongruous, it's weird that Mal is kind of jocular here, where in the previous episode he was still kind of gruff and disapproving, and you would think it would take a little more thaw. But in this episode, clearly the marching orders were make him a little likable from the outset.
I don't know, but, you know, like... like we talked about last time, like there's a certain sense in which TV of this era had to be sort of in stasis. Like, you know, the pilot episode can be a, you can have an arc, you can have your character kind of going from, you know, where they are at the, you know, at the very beginning of the story to where they're going to end up for, you know, most of the rest of the series. But then once you get them to that point, then they're just, you know, they can't really change very much because you can't serialize the story quite as well as you could, obviously, in 2019.
I think this episode also does another fine job of quietly establishing the whole alliance versus independence concept.
It, better, honestly, in some ways than the pilot does, to be completely frank.
How so? How so?
That's one of the things I was talking about. I just, you know,
I'm curious how you think.
They show that opening scene in the original pilot, right? We see them fighting for the alliance, and then the alliance turning on them, and then we cut to however many years later it is, and then there's not a whole lot more. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I feel like this episode, you know, between their discussions and between that opening fight and that fight being about, okay, hey, this, you know, these people love the alliance. Mal hates the alliance and he's willing to, you know, start a bar fight over it. You don't get to see, you know, the alliance sort of being evil. So I guess you get more of a sense that they're just kind of like, oh, I don't really like big government. I'm just kind of a lone wolf, you know, go it alone kind of thing.
Right. You need that early. You need, that's why the pilot was so, you know, now it's just like, oh, he's anti-establishment. Yeah. And that's all. But in the pilot episode, we see he's anti-establishment because the establishment betrayed him, killed his friends, and left him for dead.
Right.
So, you know, that context matters. Now we have a great villain. He does come back later. And it is just one of those one of those misdirect villains where it's like, oh, this guy looks like a frail old man who might be, he might talk intimidating or whatever, but how scary could he really be? And guess what? He's plenty
this
scared.
Scene is so good. This whole his spiel that he gives about, like, reputation, and he's like, oh, reputation is just words. And then he shows him the dude hanging from the ceiling, and he's like, there you go. Now my reputation's not words. How are you going to show me your reputation with your actions? And you realize that's, you know, that's then setting up Mal's conflict later on, because now you know this is not a dude that you double cross. And when he is sort of forced to later on, you realize just and this how important it is to him, you know?
This touches on what you said earlier in that Joss Whedon is a good writer. He knows that we have seen many, many TV shows and movies in which we have to establish this is not a villain to F with. Like, we've seen it in James Bond movies. Yeah. We've seen it in Jason Bourne movies. We've seen it in horror films, comedies, action thrillers, revenge movies. We've seen countless scenes in which the message of the scene is, you don't betray this villain. And this is a really good one, period.
No.
That's all? That's it.
The easy way to do this would be to just, you know, would be through performance, would be to have the guy, like, being this sort of, like, sniveling, you know, bad guy that you don't really want, you know, the
or
Anton
Chigurh feral monster,
kind of, you
know, a monster with an axe sitting on a dead body,
right,
or just something vicious,
which, you know,
and out of,
and they kind of do that a little bit by showing you the guy that he's torturing, but he's so playing against type, like, he's, you know, the actor and the writing is playing against that type, that you, it really is just like, you need to look at what my actions are telling you, and the smile on my face is lying to you, you know, kind of thing.
Both episodes, I think, was Whedon and Mynear, I think their main goal was to show that Mal and his crew are more than willing to be shady, but yet they both both episodes show that there's a point where they won't.
Right.
You know, the first episode was about these bars of that we thought were of, like, you know, valuable gold or something, but was just food. And now in this episode, it's when he discovers, yeah, I'll go steal this item. And when he discovers that it's medicine that these local people need desperately,
right,
you don't doubt for a second that he's going to make it right, even though now we've already built.
Right.
What have we built? This
exactly.
horrible villain.
What are the consequences? Exactly. That's, you know, and that's classic good storytelling where you make somebody make a really, really difficult choice. And when the choice that they make, you know, because you know that, like, if Jane were in charge of this crew, he wouldn't hesitate to just say, you know what, screw these people. I don't care whether they need medicine or not. I want to make money off of this stuff, you know? And somebody weaker than Mal, who still had a moral compass might decide, you know what, look, it really pains me to have to steal this medicine from these people, but this dude is a bad dude, and if we cross him, we're screwing ourselves. So I hate doing it, but I have to. And Mal, of course, says, you know what, I hate giving this back, but I have to. These
2 points.
Yep, I was going to say.
Point of, both point of science and point of motion picture fact. Point of motion picture fact, and I think you were about to say it. Those all those suits are borrowed, and he mentions it. Whedon mentioned it himself more than once in interviews. Those suits are taken from what film?
From Starship Troopers.
Correctamundo. And point of science query, Stephen. Yep. We didn't talk about the potential science of what is that train running on?
Presumably, it's some sort of maglev train. Those exist. I mean, you know, like the monorails at Disney World, they're not quite so futuristic as that. But there are like super, super fast maglev trains in Japan, I believe, and certainly in some Asian countries. Not in America, because Americans have some weird thing against trains, apparently. But the way that...
No, I think the problem that American government has is they're not willing to spend the money that it would take to invest in a brilliant new technology when they could just pocket that money and put nominal funds back into rickety old wood and nails.
Right. So the way that those trains work is, I mean, they're called maglev trains because they are magnetic levitating trains. So, you know, a magnet, if you've ever had, obviously you've played with magnets before, if you take the north pole of a magnet and stick it near the north pole of another magnet, they push each other apart. So that's sort of the basic sort of thing. Like the magnets, there are magnets on the train that are pushing up against.
I'll have you know, Stephen, just so you know, I've never played with magnets because my religion believes that they are the devil's playthings.
You know, it's not too far off. I don't know.
Magnets are, I used to fascinate me as a kid, and they kind of,
they're weird.
Kind of still do. I know. I don't get how they work.
It is really weird when you like feel them and you try to push them together and you can't. Like that to me is even weirder than like, you know, magnets sticking together. You feel like, okay, well, it's a magnet and it's sticking to a metal thing or sticking to each other. Like I get that. But magnets pushing each other apart is just so, it's so, feels
well,
so weird.
All right, now we're getting into it in a real, real quick way. Explain how magnets work.
Okay, so electricity and magnetism are the same thing. That's the first thing you have to understand. So the way that you create a magnetic field is you move electricity around. And the way you create one of the ways you create an electric field is you move magnets around. So if I took a loop of wire and I ran a current through it, that would turn it into a magnet. So the little electrons are going around in a circle in a loop of wire would create a magnetic field. And, you know, that's essentially how most microphones work. It's how a speaker, how an engine works. You have this coil of wire and you run electricity through it at a variable rate. And that causes the magnet, the permanent magnet that's stuck inside it, will move back and forth. And that, you know, then generates sound waves if it's a speaker. But permanent magnets are slightly different. It's the same sort of general principle, but permanent magnets are made out of iron for the most part, or, you know, have iron in them. And the iron atoms, for lack of a better word, spin. And if you take all of those spinning iron atoms and point them in the same direction, they start to reinforce one another, and then the whole chunk of material becomes magnetized as a result. So it's the same general principle. It's still charges that are moving around. In this case, it's electrons that are spinning around atoms as opposed to electrons that are like moving around in a coil of wire. But it's the same basic.
So what's the difference between, all right, we all know how two magnets stick together. That's a common thing we see every day. But now explain how these trains work in which there is no physical connection and yet they are somehow locked together.
Well, so like essentially there's two different things happening. There's the levitation part. So you have magnets and the magnets that are in the track are pushing up on the magnets that are on the train, and that causes the train to go upward. And then you change the electricity going through the magnets on the track, and essentially, like, I'm trying to think of a good way to do it, a way to think about it. So, like, imagine, you know, if you had a magnet, right, and you, if you took, so, like, say you stuck a magnet on your desk, right, and you wanted to make that magnet move across your desk, you could take another magnet and come up towards that magnet, and it would push that magnet away, and you would never need them to actually touch each other, right, because you could just come near it, and it would push that away, and if you kept moving your magnet.
Right, you could make two toy magnets repel, you could make one repel the other without them ever
touching.
Right,
and you could then use that if you just took one of them with your hand and moved it continually towards the other one, you could push it all the way across the desk, and that's essentially sort of what's happening, is that you're manipulating the magnets in the track such that it's always always pushing the train in one direction, and then you know, the computer is controlling them so that it, you know, depending on how fast the train is moving, you're essentially, you know, the equivalent of standing behind it with a giant magnet running as fast as you can and pushing it forward via that magnet, only obviously a lot more complicated than that in reality.
You know what else this episode gets right? I said as I tried to sneak a cookie during this episode. talk a little bit about Mal and Zoe.
I mean, you know, I don't know. I think it does a good job of establishing their dynamic. You know what? I mean, in all honesty, I feel like that's one of the weaker parts of this episode, in my opinion. Just knowing sort of where they go as characters. Like, she feels a little sidekicky in a lot of this stuff.
It bugs me in that they were forced to shorthand some really great character stuff that they did in episode one. And now you could see them trying to be like, all right, how do we get Mal and Zoe together? All right, well, as they sneak onto the train, we give them some banter to establish that they know and love each other and blah, blah, blah. But
she's mostly following his lead, and that, you know.
Yeah, but we never really get the weight of their relationship there.
No. But you do in plenty in other episodes, so it's not, you know.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
And there's our bug.
Also, there was almost a science question there of when he falls on the chain out of the ship onto the train, wouldn't he also fall backwards?
Yeah, I mean, like, the wind might push him back a little bit, but he's traveling the same speed as the spaceship is, so.
Okay.
You know, but the wind would probably push him back a little bit, but he falls pretty quickly. And so he would move back maybe a little bit. I don't know. It depends on how fast they're going, how fast the wind is.
Look at Wash and his big muscles right there. How about that for some science? Alan Tudyk was like, yo, I get to show off my guns. Do I get to show off my guns in this episode?
This whole alliance troops on the thing, in the context of the entire episode, feels a little bit like a...
MacGuffin?
Just like let's just add a complication. We can't just have them steal.
Yeah, roadblock.
Yeah, we need to, let's put some alliance. It doesn't really pay off a whole lot.
But you know what it does pay off is that later in the episode, it's made clear that, these alliance soldiers did nothing while there was a theft. And that is thematically interesting, you know,
except
because it just kind of underlines one did, you know.
Yeah. That's kind of mean what they just did. Those were a bunch of civilians in there, and they just threw a bunch of tear gas or whatever it was in there.
We should keep a running tally of who gets shot in this series. In episode one, Kaylee gets shot, and Mal also gets shot, right?
I think so. In this one, he gets stabbed towards the end.
Right, and in this episode, Jane gets shot.
And Zoe gets shot in this one too, doesn't she?
She gets shot in the first one.
Is that the one I'm thinking of? Where she has the bulletproof
vest
shot
on? Yeah, she had the vest on at the end.
I couldn't remember if that was that last episode.
Everybody who hasn't been shot yet.
I can't not see those guys as troopers, as Starship Troopers, mobile infantry. Oh, look, it's the mobile infantry.
Who's that? You mean the great Greg Henry?
No, I'm just talking about the guys wearing the
you're talking about uniforms. The costumes. Yeah, it is a little distracting. But this gentleman here who just showed up is a character actor named Greg Henry.
Oh, I'm very familiar with his work. He is a regular on one of my favorite television shows of all time.
Which is?
Gilmore Girls.
All right. And why should tell me? I know many, many people, and you know me, I am certainly not like manly man who has a problem with female-themed shows. New Girl is one of my all-time favorite sitcoms. I adore it. So I certainly don't have a problem watching something called The Gilmore Girls, but I want you to sell me on it in 30 seconds. Go.
I mean, the writing is brilliant from beginning to end, but really when it comes down to it, the reason why I love Gilmore Girls is because I see parts of myself in every single character in that show. The sort of rich, cold, distant parents that she doesn't want to have to rely on but does, the unrequited, you know, pining after Lorelai that Luke does, the smart girl that goes to a new school.
Time up. I'll watch it. I definitely will.
Yeah. No, but the writing is brilliant. The writing is
I've always heard that it's just really funny. That's what I've heard, is just that you get into the characters and that makes it doubly funny. But I've just heard repeatedly that, yes, it has this very signature style, rapid banter. And if you want to nitpick that, you can if you want. But it's also housing a lot of funny stuff.
Well, and a lot of heart, too. It's very, very funny and very, you know, it's a dramedy. And I love good dramedies.
P.S. If anybody out there has never watched New Girl, please do. You'll laugh your asses off.
So here is our first introduction to the dock and river. Yes.
Or our first new introduction. Timeline. Yeah.
Right, exactly. In the TV Watchers timeline. So I may draw some ire from people, but I think she's amazing in the movie. I don't feel like her character ever quite gelled in the series in a way that I found believable or interesting. I'd always felt a little bit too much like she's acting too hard to me.
I think that happens a lot when an actor is, you know, brand new, and whether that's they are green and just getting comfortable with their acting style, or it's just that our eyeballs are brand new to this person, right, and therefore they seem a little bit sketchy and a little bit wooden or alien to us. I also think that the role is remarkably difficult because she has to be both a little bit creepy and also worthy of our sympathy, you know.
It's definitely. And again, I feel like she nailed that tone in the movie.
At this point, she is kind of like, not to be unkind, but she's almost a specimen. She's almost like, you know, a subject that has to be watched.
Exactly.
By the time we reach the later episodes and Serenity, she's a full-bore character.
Right.
Like, she's got many, many shades. And
she feels like a collection of quirks right now and not a character.
Yeah, yeah. So. And it also, I think that also speaks to the problem of, hey, everybody, you did in episode one kind of introduce yourselves to the viewer, but now you kind of have to do it again. And, like, Jane, that's an easy character to reintroduce.
Right.
But you know, Inara, that's not such an easy character to introduce twice, you know? And neither is River, so.
Yeah. And they do it in a great way later on, too. And they introduce the whole idea of the companion really, really great later on, too. Shepherd Book has this line where he's like, we got, you know, somebody's got to rescue these two. And so Shepherd Book's like, well, we need to send somebody respectable. And you think he's talking about himself, but he's not. He's talking about Inara.
Yep. And it is. It's important. It's almost like they have like a fugitive prince who, like, when they really need to pull out, like, the blue blood and pull out some, like, credentials. And it's like that they do have that character, and it's also the person who is a prostitute.
Right, and it establishes through action, not just through dialogue. It establishes through action. It establishes through how every other character reacts to her that, you know, her profession is not only legitimate but, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Respected, you know?
Yep, some gravity, some actual meat on the character.
So now, were those
Greg Henry,
Christmas
like you're
lights?
Wondering, what do you know? What do you know Greg Henry from, movie fans? Think Slither.
Is he in Slither?
Yeah, he also plays.
He's in Super
Grandpa
as well.
He's in Guardians 1, and I think, yeah, says here too. Yep, he's in Guardians 1 and 2.
And he's
obviously
Super,
a fan.
Which is my favorite James Gunn movie, personally. He plays the cop.
Oh, Super, yep. He's a James Gunn guy. And he's great at playing a bad guy, but here he's just he's the opposite of a bad guy. He's just a sheriff looking for the medicine that these local people need. And he could be livid and angry and furious and rolling around and being, because Greg Henry is really good at being feral and mean and nasty, but here he never tips that. He's just completely a good, noble guy, and you never buy that he's going to be a bad guy.
There are some great moments in here of Mal acting, you know, you know, Nathan Fillion being Mal, pretending to be this sort of yokel guy.
And being conflicted by the information that he's getting.
Right.
You know, and also trying to hide his, you know,
but not so much that he's giving it away to the cop that's interrogating him, you know.
And Gina Torres also doing some good background acting here, where she is also like recognizing Mal's discomfort and also learning this information, you know.
You just get the sense that Mal is used to sort of lying when he needs to and doesn't feel bad about it, but he's not a jerk. I know it's just a really hard, because to me in real life, liars are the people that I kind of have the least amount of respect for. But I guess it's the fact that Mal has a code of honor. Like most liars, I guess, don't. Most liars are just liars, and you know, they'd stab you in the back.
Well, I mean, it kind of speaks to the whole criminal mind, because okay, here's the story. Let's say these mostly likable group took a job from a dangerous guy, and now they discover that the job they took is hurting innocent people.
Right.
Well, Now, a lot of criminals have a decision to make. Do I cross the very dangerous boss who could hurt me, or do I, you know, do the right thing? And what? You're already, when you're a criminal, you're already halfway in that shady ground.
You're like 95% of the way in there. So, right. Like, yeah, I don't think most criminals would do
and
that.
It's not because they're necessarily bad people. It's because they go, well, shit, now I have a choice to make. I either screw these people who need their medicine, or I get my head cut off. And, you know, right. That's kind of what creates the criminal, as putting yourself in that awful position. And, you know, I love that our heroes in science fiction and you know, pulp yeah. action and in most Joss Whedon stories are kind of shady great. Until – yeah, this is great, Al Jane. Great fall, too. Great fall.
It's just they draw that moment out in a way that they would – you know, like, again, that's just some like
– I also love – love Wash's question. He doesn't say, did he pass out? He said, did he just go crazy and fall asleep? Just a weird way to say that. And it's funny. It might be for exposition, yeah. But it's funny.
So you want to know what I knew Alan Tudyk most from before I saw this movie?
God, I love – who doesn't love Alan Tudyk, man? God, is he great.
The thing that I remember most him most from before prior to the Serenity movie was 28 Days with Sandra Bullock.
Yes.
Which is an underrated movie, in my opinion.
I have not seen it since it was in theaters, but I saw it with my friends opening weekend. He's just one of those people that you – I don't even remember the first time
him
I
and,
saw Alan
Him
Tudyk.
And Viggo Mortensen. It was the first time I'd seen either of those two guys.
Oh, God. She has a great moment to shine here, Marina.
Yeah. And she's, you know, this – you know, she, you can tell she – She
angry.
Loves being able to right. She's playing really, really angry, but at the same time, you can tell.
Oh, and Gina, that little Gina
that
Torres,
little look right there.
She does that shameful little look down. God, is that funny? You can already see these actors really getting each other's beats. You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a good director, man. That's how you like all of these roles are cast really, really well, and the rhythm of the scene with the good writing and the good directing just kind of like. Again, you're putting these people in interesting situations, right? Because now has just, to swallow his feelings.
She's so charming. She's so charming to him. And then she turns around and she's not only is she vicious, but she's enjoying this turnabout. She's enjoying this moment of not only am I saving them, but I get to slap him for being a jerk.
And then you can't tell whether Mal is like, there's a weird way in which you can't tell whether he's reacting in character to being chewed out by Inara, or whether he's, you know, genuinely
it's
ashamed.
Arguably, like, caught. You know, it's a three of our main characters and a great guest actor, and it might be the best character beats we've had in the two episodes yet. And, you know, it's just good writing and good acting.
Yeah. Oh, so that's.
I love that this is now it. Let's talk about that. Inara's shuttle. How it kind of connects into the side of Firefly, and they establish that. Oh, Jane has a great line here. Wait, we're not going. And what does Jane say? Something like, we were coming for you. What do you mean back? I waited for you guys. He wanted to leave them behind so badly that they had to drug him. He's completely, almost completely obliterated, but he knows enough to lie and say, we were coming, I was coming for you.
Yeah, and this is, again, a great piece of writing here where it's like, boom, you know what? We're not going to let you go back to these guys and tell them you did the thing. We're going to just
right, and we're, you know, show up. It's almost this beautiful naivete because the audience, every audience member who's into this dialogue knows, what do you mean you're going to just give Niska the money back? You can't be that naive that you think you can just, and then without even giving us a moment for them to get back on the ship and travel, it's boom, here's four henchmen.
Yep. And then cut
including one of them who played Leatherface in the remake. He played Leatherface in the Chainsaw remake.
Who is that?
Andrew Bryniarski. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I didn't realize that was him.
That is him. And, you know, and we are kind of like, if you really want to get like nitpicky, we are kind of covering the same themes that we covered in the first episode, in that they're going on a heist, and then their morality gets involved. And then once their morality gets involved, some nasty stuff happens.
Yeah. But again, like I feel like they had to do that once they realized that this was now going to be the pilot. They had to establish that. And again, I feel like for me, like this episode does a better job of establishing Mal's character, I think, than the original pilot does.
I think we both know why. I think the reason they chose this episode to be the pilot, even though, well, I could be talking out of turn, I don't know.
I think the reason
they chose this is because of the moment coming up, this key moment of something that Mal does unexpected to this villain. No. And I think that was the moment they wanted to have, like, if... Will people talk about this scene? Yeah. Will people talk about this moment? Like, it's really different.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what they were going for.
You know,
it is a great moment, but it's
the
not
fight
a pilot
scenes
moment.
Are a little bit clunky.
All in a close up when they're in this ship. They're all too close up a little.
Yeah.
But, yep, Jane.
But that's probably because they probably had, you know, like a half a day to shoot the whole thing. And so they're just like, all right, let's just shoot this as quickly as possible. Because
yeah,
TV
it works.
Schedule.
It works. But yeah, it does seem a little close quarters. You're right.
Especially given how, how much we know about. Whedon's ability to stage action sequences from his later work. He's clearly capable of, although I don't know if he directed this episode or not. I didn't notice, so I don't know. And this, again, is a great little moment to, like, rather than having them go back and just leave the medicine off, you add this extra complication of the, you get the sheriff to be able to sort of close his arc.
And what I love about this is, man, what I really love about this is that it starts to sprinkle out, like, you would get that Mal doing these things would build his legend, that him and his Firefly crew are scoundrels, they're smugglers, they're crooks, but they're also not trash.
Right.
they have a heroic side. They have a noble side. We got it from episode one, and we're getting it here, that you would kind of, the word would get out. In a longer series, that these are not mercenaries; these are good guys.
Yeah, I mean, and that kind of pays off in the you know, one of the last episodes about the them defending the whorehouse.
Mm-hmm. We say brothel on this podcast.
Brothel. I was trying to think of the euphemism for it, and I couldn't. So
cat house,
flop house.
Yeah.
Is that what a flop house is?
I did some checking for you, but you were right. Whedon directed. Yeah, it is. And you could see Whedon and Tim sitting down going, all right, how can we reestablish that he has a real moral code? But if you are an unreasonable, violent dick, like you think this sidekick is going to be like a tertiary character, right? Like you think he's going to fight him again in the future. No.
Yeah,
you build up an ostensibly meaningful character just to build up your main character. That's what he's there for.
Exactly. Right. And then we get this last little beat at the end of this scene after he kicks him in. Which wouldn't that? I mean, point of science. I feel like that probably wouldn't do very good things for your spaceship engine, to be honest.
Right.
I don't really understand spaceship engines.
I mean, here's my point of science, extra point, and that's a great beat when he, you know, we all know the beat. The second guy is going to go, yes, sir, no problem, sir. But they still make it funny. Yep. It's still funny. So it's like when you can, like, telegraph a punchline and it's still funny, then you're a good filmmaker, period. Yeah. But the point of science would be, if that engine was hot enough to cook him before his bones broke the engine, there's no way they could be that close to
him. Right. Well, there's that.
And if it didn't burn him instantly, then his bones would almost definitely damage the engine.
Right. Clog up something, you know, like you see that similar sort of scene a lot of times with airplanes in non-science fiction movies where somebody gets sucked into a jet. It happened in,
Game night,
yeah. You know, and if you know,
I love it.
This is literally brought planes down before, like where a goose or a bird of some sort will fly into. I mean, that's what happened in Sully. Birds flew into the engine and it just completely destroyed the engine. And at that point, you're kind of screwed. So I guess, you know, again, there's space engines. So here's one place where we finally establish
some arc.
Right. And that the Alliance is not just sort of a benign, you know, government that he's kind of anti-establishment.
Well, yeah, at this point we established that the Alliance was like an uncaring government, not necessarily evil, but completely uncaring. And now we have this principle, these characters within the Alliance that are clearly malevolent, and I love that we've killed his sidekick in interesting fashion, but fans will, of course, notice that Niska does return later and does turn out to be an interesting villain again.
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering if you were watching this for the first time, if you would feel, I don't want to say cheated, but like feel like it was incomplete that they didn't deal with Niska and the fallout from this in that episode.
Yeah. Well, it's worth mentioning that, yes, this episode did premiere as the pilot. It premiered first on September 20th, 2002. We want to thank you for tuning in to our patron episode. We will be back. Our next episode will probably be something not Firefly, but we are going to do the whole series, although not exclusively. So on behalf of Dr. DeGennaro and myself, thank you so much for tuning in. We love Firefly, and we will be back with episode 3 soon.
Thank you, guys.